Hello everyone, Nexa here, and I'm joined with Greytome and Arta Magnus, and it's a DM night session. We're just going to talk about a couple of things that are giving us angst or things that we think are pretty cool when it comes to all things dungeon mastering. And so, go ahead.
Is it just dungeon mastering, or can I bring up the fact that last week it was 70 degrees here in Chicago, and then we got 2 inches of snow, and I wish the weather would make up its mind. Can I gripe about that, or we want to keep it strictly to gaming?
I guess we want to keep it strictly gaming, though I will say Angle Cow, I was actually just texting him, and he has 22 inches of snow where he's at.
Okay, then I'm going to keep quiet then.
That's what happens when you go to Michigan in the middle of nowhere. So he deserves that.
And we just alienated everyone in Michigan from the site. Thanks, guys. Okay, we love Michigan. No, we're big fans. You have...
Hold on here. I don't have anything against Michigan. They make all my furniture. Okay, come on. Grand Rapids.
So we're really going off the rails here. Yeah, we haven't even started any discussion.
There's still 49 states that we have yet to insult. Well, I think I'll kind of jump into it with just experiences from over this past weekend, because I got a chance to finally run Starfinder, which is a big diversion for me, because over the last year I've been playing in Marvel Super Heroes, the Phase Rip system, the original TSR Phase Rip system, playing a lot of games along those lines, and running 5th edition D&D for the last year or so, where I've really gotten to a regular rhythm where I've been playing regularly. I running Curse of Strahd on Roll20 and then having a group locally. But I finally got a chance to break out a session and crack open that Starfinder core rulebook and really enjoy that. It's a different system. It was a learning curve, because this is different than the games I've been playing recently. We did start off running a Pathfinder game that we eventually rolled into a D&D 5th edition game. And Starfinder was really unlike, I mean, it had some similarities to it. It's a D20 based system, but it was unlike any of the other games I had played recently. So it was quite a departure and kind of a learning experience for me running the game and the players. Starfinder's
Yeah, and I was going to say, I'm going to chime in, but I was just going to say that I enjoyed the game as well, having actually connected on Roll20 and actually playing it. I really enjoyed the ship scenario where we were actually going to a different planet. I got to play the science officer. So I have to admit, it was actually pretty good game system.
It ran smoothly, I have to say, because we started off with some light RP to kind of get people warmed up to their characters, kind of get started, because they're playing a different set of classes. With Starfinder, with their theme, you know, you choose the icon, and then you choose your race, which could be human, and there's several different alien races, not to mention they have all of the legacy races from Pathfinder. So you want to play an elf or a dwarf, you know, have all that. Then you choose your class, like an envoy, or you can be a ace pilot Lashunta, which is kind of a telepathic race, operative, like a special agent in a sci-fi setting. So it gave characters kind of a chance to get into the feel of things, and then rolled into some combat with a group of space goblins, which turned out to be pretty interesting. So yeah, I think it flowed well. I mean, it was an interesting system and the way they handled things. So I enjoyed running. I'm glad you guys enjoyed playing in it.
Definitely a good game. Yeah. Now, I've actually taken on the mantle and I've been DMing Pathfinder. And I'll start with one of the angst. This one is actually on me. I really have to get combat down, because it takes me so long to actually figure out what certain rules are, because if it's something that a player can do that's not within the basic knowledge set of the rules where I have to look it up, it takes me a minute, and I find myself blurring the lines between Pathfinder and D&D 5th edition. because I kind of know some of the rule sets, but the biggest one is I have to stop and remind people that you can either attack and move or move and attack, but you can't do both of them. You can't attack, move, and then attack, or move, attack, move. And so just little things like that annoy me, yeah, just because I have to actually get better on reading up all the rules. As a player, I'll admit, I'm lazy when it comes to rules. I feel like that's the DM job. My job is to be the player and get into the role of my character and do all that. But as the DM, it's a bigger responsibility. So,
okay, so I have a response to that whole comment and to the whole issue with Pathfinder. So
okay.
There's a reason why Pathfinder is made fun of it. It's called Dungeons & Dragons 3.75, because we all remember 3.5.
Yeah.
Which was just out of control. And Pathfinder became 3.75 for a reason. They streamlined the little thing, but it's still just overcomplicated. You have so many books, so many characters, so many races that a GM just cannot keep track of it all. And it's interesting that you said it's the GM's job. So it's funny that you say that, because the reason, when he was talking about how we went from a Pathfinder to a D&D game, that was my game. Now, I run two Pathfinder games. One was with a group of elite players that know Pathfinder better than I do. And I know Pathfinder really well. Like, on a scale of 1 to 10, I put myself at 7, 8. But the guys that I play with are 9, 10 easily. And the game runs so smooth because they maintain everything for their character. Now, when I was running it for Tony and for Ed and everyone who joins us in our, you know, that are my friends from long, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I felt that you guys were putting too much pressure on me to maintain the rules among the players, because for the exact same reason that you just said it, because you felt that you need to play and not run the rules of your character. And I think that's an absolute mistake. I would never, ever, will I ever run Pathfinder with a group of players who do not have at least an equal or similar or very close level of skill in the rules of Pathfinder. I would rather just play D&D 5th edition for that reason. And, you know, as I said
before.
But
is it that you rather play it because you feel like you have the mastery of 5th edition, or...
No, it's
that Pathfinder is just too complicated.
It's too complicated for me to run by myself. That does require players to track multiple attacks. There are multiple modifiers. There's modifiers for everything. I mean, there's just so much, and there's so many feats and combinations and ways to break the system that the GM has to try even harder to keep things in check. D&D is very restrictive in everything that it does. Cannot fly until 3rd level. Cannot teleport until 5th level. You know what I mean? Pathfinder, you can do all that at like 2nd level. You know, and it's just one of those games where like you have to restrict what you're doing or limit it or just have a basic understanding of the possible dynamics that each player can create within his own character. So that's just, I had to chime in on that because, you know, I run, as you know, I run several games, about 6 games on Roll20, all of them different genres. From Marvel to Pathfinder to World of Darkness to my favorite game currently running, I have to say, is Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire. That's a freaking game. I think how people are not playing this game more often blows my mind. It's an amazing game. Why? Because it's so basic, like 5e. There's hardly any rules. You can pretty much do anything you want. No alignment system. No rules to anything. No magic, really. And it's just awesome.
Well, to just piggyback on what you said, now I feel bad. Because, I do. Because once I'm in the DM shoes, I can see and I can really empathize with you. So I completely understand. And I do know, just in my favor, I do know some of the rules, but some of the intricacies of, like, you know, what can you do with a charge? How far can you move? There's a lot of rules.
Yep.
It's a lot to keep track of. No, I definitely agree with that. And it, Well, I think that's one thing that they really did well in fifth edition was basically advantage and disadvantage. Instead of adding and subtracting multipliers, you look at situations and do you have advantage, disadvantage? Is there anything that's going to cancel out? If there's a situation that I would say, well, this is going to grant disadvantage, and there's something else, I'm like, well, you get advantage from that. Okay, it's a level playing field. They canceled each other out. So I kind of like that because it just makes on the fly decisions by the DM. When I'm running, I can just say, okay, you're going to have disadvantage on that roll. Okay, I'm going to give you advantage on given the circumstances or something you did. So I do like that. And I've noticed because right now I'm playing in a fourth edition game. I'm running two fifth edition games. Now I'm running Starfinder. I'm playing in your Pathfinder game, Nexa. Ray, I'm in your fifth edition game. I'm starting to actually run into a problem where I'm getting rules mixed up. With the movement, it's like, okay, wait a minute. Can I move an attack, then finish my movement? I'm like, is that allowed? Okay, what was that? Oh no, that was a fifth edition. Okay, this is Pathfinder. No, I can't do that. And it's just the rules start blending together, and it's like, no, lightning bolt automatically hits. No, this is fourth edition. I got to roll the strike with that. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, that's right. So, in my Curse of Strahd fifth edition game, I was rolling to hit on lightning bolt. Now, I want to thank my players, who hopefully you are listening to this, who were in roll 20 in the chat window
Thirty-six.
saying, hey, that's not right. He's not supposed to be rolling hit. Those rolls should automatically hit. I want to really say thank you to all my players who didn't call me out on that. But no, it was just something, it's after the fact. It's like, oh, wait a minute, I did that wrong. But it's just a matter of keeping it all straight. And I do agree. I think I like Pathfinder. It's a good system. I'm really enjoying your game, Nexa. It's a lot of fun. And I applaud you because I don't think it's been a while since you'd run a game. And I think this is your first time running Pathfinder. You'd run D&D in the past, Marvel, things like that. But, this is the first time you're really, and especially on Roll 20, where we're not at the table. To put that together, and then as a first time out, I'm still enjoying it. The because I'm learning those rules too. I played Pathfinder for a while. I've never run it, so I'm still kind of learning those rules and the ins and outs and intricacies of what we can do. It's not getting the fun, in the way of having fun playing the game. We're all learning. And you started out with what's that, seven players total?
Seven players, yep.
Yeah,
Showing up faithfully, seven players.
yeah.
But that I actually have a question for you, Art Magnus, because since you're actually, and Great Tom, you to a lesser extent, eventually you'll get to this area, but do you find it hard actually creating encounters for your players in fifth edition?
Okay. Do you want to take this one, Tony, or you want me to go first?
Wait,
No,
could you?
I was doing you first because I
Okay.
know Gray Tom is actually doing a module, so he doesn't have that issue just yet.
Okay. So before I answer that question, let me say one thing about that. Because first of all, the answer is no. I think creating encounters in fifth edition is the easiest thing on the face of the planet. In fact, the way they construct encounters is 100 times less complicated than running an encounter in fourth edition, or especially Pathfinder, where you have to keep
Sit.
track of the average party level, and then you have to the difficulties and encounters and all that. You don't have to do any of that in fifth edition,
And see,
which.
that's why I asked this question, because I find to create the encounters that I use in Pathfinder relatively easy and straightforward. And so far, with just a minor bit of tweaking, I think I'm really challenging my players, whereas I'm not, completely overrunning them, but it's not a cakewalk for them either. And great time, you could chime in if that's true or not.
No, absolutely. I think you've got a really well balanced encounter. It's definitely a threat, but it's not an insurmountable one. We have to think smart and work as a team. With Curse of Strahd, on running that on Roll 20, yeah, the campaign sets, but I've modified a lot of those encounters heavily, and added to existing encounters because I look at what the story crafts, and then they put a character in. I'm like, well, okay, I've got six people. I know these are experienced players. Six on one at their level, because y'all are ninth level now in that game, so you're getting up there where you're really bringing some of the heavy firepower and special abilities that you have. So, with that being said, it just I need to kind of tweak the encounter a little bit. I mean, I work with some of the encounter tables, but personally, a lot of times just crunching the math and what the rules say, okay, based on the points, this encounter is going to be a challenge. I've had players roll over those encounters because they're experienced, they know how to do it. I've actually taken in fifth edition, I threw a drider, a bunch of large spiders, a couple giant spiders, and some kobolds against a group of six second level characters, and it all came down to one last stand with one character. I mean, I almost had a total party kill, but the sorcerer was able to save that from that TPK at the last moment, and it was just an epic time. I had an idea of what I wanted to do if I did wipe the party, and how that was going to go. It wasn't necessarily going to be the end for those characters. I had some plans in store, so didn't see those through, but that's okay because we just kept with the regular
Two
game we were going. So.
things. First, Artemags, I want you to explain how you generate yours. And second, for anyone listening, TPK is an acronym for total player kill or total party kill
Total party kill.
or total party wipe. You know, just acronyms is a pet peeve of mine because, never mind. Go ahead, Artemags, if you could
So
tell me.
the way I build an encounter, I okay, so again, okay, so I, as you know, never use optional rules except in fifth edition because fifth edition is checkers and I refuse to play checkers. Once you play chess, you just can't
Uh-oh.
play checkers, right? So I actually have been using almost every, not every, I'd say about 80% of the optional rules in fifth edition. Not in your guys' game, but I have in other games that I'm running, and it's amazing, right? I think it's much better. The game is
Well,
much
use the
better.
flanking.
Yeah, that's one. I use healing surges in my other game. I use flanking. I use the facing and the initiative optional rule, which I think is awesome in fifth edition. In fact, I'm thinking about switching it in our game. But anyway, I digress from that. But to building an encounter, I am very legitimate. I never stray from the experience points. I literally go onto a website called, I can't even think of it. I think it's called GNU. GNU is a Pathfinder website, and it automates everything. I also have Hero Lab, where it can create encounters for me. So it tells me how many party members I have, what level is everyone. And it gives me my ECM, what type of terrain, what type of perception checks they should make, at what range, and all that. It tells me all of this. And then I just feed in those numbers based off of the experience value of the encounter, and I'm allowed to add it up until I get to a certain point. And that's it. That's literally what I do. Now, if you're talking about like what I'm doing specifically to build any, like if you're telling me experience-wise to go up against the players, that's what I do. I do not deviate from what the book says ever. Very rarely. When I do, it's usually because there is an optional rule in Pathfinder where you can give additional experience based off of terrain. For example, if you put six goblins in a tower, right, in arrow slits, well, that's not just six goblins. You have to count the tower, the fact that they have a -8 cover, 50% cover, like, right, that makes the encounter that much harder. So you add one extra level to all the goblins because the way you constructed the encounter is so difficult, right? Because of terrain or traps or whatever, right? But if you're asking me how do I construct it, like how do I link up my monsters, here's what I do personally. I create a theme, right? I try to pick a monster as my theme. So if you're in the forest and I want the villains to be, say, goblins, then I try to pick all goblins. And in Pathfinder, there's multiple variations of goblins. You can construct goblins from almost anything. There's like, I think, 12, 13 variations of goblins. And then if you have goblins, well, they got to work for somebody. You can have orcs, you can have hobgoblins, and maybe a leader, a wizard, or a cleric, someone religious, something like. So that's how I construct my encounters based off of what you're doing. It's a theme per chapter. If you're in a town, then it's bandits or brigands or nobles or someone who's going to impede the movement of the characters. But yeah, I don't believe in like wandering monsters. For example, wandering monsters. I've actually seen DMs actually have wandering monster charts who actually row on that. What? who does that? I don't do that. You know, or DMs who can't make their decision on things like, oh, well, you're going to target this player 1 through 3 for this character 5 through 6. What? Why? Why are you doing that? What are you? Are you not confident enough in your ability to be the GM to pick on a player for a tactical reason or an untactical reason? If it's an animal, he'll attack the closest person. If it's a hobgoblin who has tactics because they're hobgoblins and they're badass in the battlefield, then they understand what a threat is and they should kill the threat of the group. Do not feel bad. Do not hesitate. That's what makes the game good. A good GM, in my opinion, to it all, is a person. The GM should be able to give the threat of killing players without actually there being a threat. The players think they're gonna die, but the odds of them dying are next to none because the GM has tactically set up his encounter in such a way that there's no way the players could die unless they do something way out in the field. That's all I got.
That's pretty good. Now we were talking. I was talking to Ed earlier about the whole thing, D&D checkers and chess thing, and just chime in that I think it's a good metaphor, but I really think that comparing D&D to checkers and Pathfinder to chess, I think chess is a game that its rule system is very easy to learn, but it's difficult to master it. You can spend years mastering that. D&D 5th edition, it's a very easy game to teach someone. You can take a new player in, get them running, get them character rolled up, fairly straightforward, get them playing, and then, yeah, you can build on it, but I think it's a more elaborate game as you start adding layers on. Now, I don't use all the optional rules in my run. I use flanking. And I kind of build my own encounters just kind of looking at, okay, what are the players, because I know what the players can handle from previous experience, and I look at, okay, how many players am I going to have? Okay, if each player has one opponent that they're dealing with, okay, is that opponent that they're going to be able to take down in 1 or 2 hits? You know, how many rounds is it going to take potentially for each player to take them out? Because if I just put a handful of them in there, then they're going to double team, and that's going to really speed that up. So it's just, I kind of look at that, and I'm interested in that sight and being able to kind of automate that to, you know, build better encounters, especially as you get into higher level, which is one thing that is kind of nice about running the campaign Curse of Strahd, because as characters level up, the encounter levels are basically mapped out. Like, okay, you're at 9th level, 10th level. I mean, basically at 10th level, you're ready. The party is ready to take on Castle Ravenloft. That's the recommended level to be to do that, and my players are getting to that point. So some of the smaller threats I'm having to build up because they have leveled up. They got the experience and milestones. And Ray, next, I'm interested in getting your opinion on this. When you're, because I can't find a clear-cut rule anywhere, and I'd really like to get your opinion on this. When you're running a game, do you use just straight experience? Do you use, because I'm running experience and a combination of milestones. So experience builds up, then you hit a milestone, it bumps you up to that level, then I award XP, and it's like, okay, that new level plus whatever they got. How do you guys handle leveling? Is it straight experience, or do you guys use the milestones at all?
Okay, me personally, I do not use the milestones.
Okay.
I think the milestones, I think, are more for Adventure League because you have to get players at a certain level.
What do you consider Adventure League, if you could just.
Adventure League, like Adventure League gaming for 5th edition, like official game at a gaming store,
Okay.
right? Now, I think that the mistake you're going to run into, Tony, is that 5th edition ends at what level?
Like 20th, isn't it?
Correct. You're already over halfway there.
So I've
What do
got
you?
like 11 levels to kill everybody off.
I mean, it's just, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I guess you can slow it down, but then if you're not going to just go right to, I guess, a combination. I mean, look, my opinion, it doesn't matter to what you're doing, right? Like, the only thing that here, for as stubborn and as extreme and as elitist as I am as a GM, I do believe that if the GM explains prior to the game what his intention, his theme, and what the point is, and the players agree, then that's all that matters. Right? Like it's when the GM is spewing out rules or changing things in the middle of a game, that's not okay.
Yeah,
right?
absolutely.
And so my opinion is I always run experience, and I'm
One
very
XP, okay.
and I'm very strict with it.
Well, for the system Pathfinder, I don't think there are per se milestones. If there are, then I definitely haven't read up on them.
There is.
But there is.
Yeah.
Okay. But what I do is I do go by experience, but I have it on the fast experience level, and part of the reason being is that I only DM every other month. And then I also everything, all of my notes, everything is actually in a binder, in a normal notebook binder. And so once I complete that binder, I'm gonna actually give everyone a level, because it'll be one book of the binder done, and I'll start the next one. Now, mind you probably won't get to the next binder until next year, because I have a lot of content. But I'm putting in a lot of notes. But I think, as it stands now, I think you guys are advancing probably once you may be leveling up once every other session, or once every three sessions, which is about right where I want you
Yeah,
to
that'd be
be.
about right.
Yeah, and I want to say that's a really great idea, Ed. I actually should have mentioned that. I do that as well. I only run my game twice a month, and I do go with medium, but I'm thinking about switching it to fast. But I don't know. How's it working out for you, Ed?
So far, so good. I
Great.
think, there.
You're moving, we're moving along at a pretty good pace. So, I mean, it's no one's like, oh, we're stuck at this level. And part of it with Curse of Strahd, it actually pinpoints specific, and that was the thing, they didn't really clarify whether this was, because you really, you got to get the players from, you can start at first level. There's a mini module you run in that I ran for you guys at Gen Con. That takes you basically using milestones from first to third, then you venture out into the land of Barovia and Ravenloft, and then you pretty ha quickly have to get the characters up to a certain level. And I think, Ray, that's probably why they have the milestones, because like, hey, before you can take on Ravenloft, you need to be at 10th level, so we're gonna throw some milestones out, like finding some key
That's
artifacts
smart.
are a milestone. Each major encounter is a milestone, and I think that's basically as you go through, you're leveling up.
The only other thing that I want to add up is the only thing that I do different from you guys is that actually for everyone who shows up on time, because I start promptly at the time I say I'm going to start, I give them experience. And it's only, it's a between 100 and 150, depending on the night and how I'm feeling and everything like that. But just an incentive for everyone to be on time. And so far, everyone has been on time. Can you believe that, bro?
Everyone has, so it's a good game. Yeah, it's running well, so.
I have a question for everyone.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel about different party levels, different character levels within the party? Do you believe in equal experience?
I think for me personally, it just becomes a matter of it being easier to do it that way. I mean, it's just it really is just a matter of working out. I think there's a really strong argument that can be made for strong gamers that really get into their characters, and because we've all run into it where different players are involved in the game at different levels. I've been in games where guys have taken out their phones and started playing videos for other players, and it's like, hey, I put a lot of work into this. I don't necessarily want to call anybody out, because it's like, yeah, it's a larger group, takes time to get around the game table, but somebody who's really into the game, who's really focused, yeah, that person deserve more experience, I think, or certain experience bonuses. But for me, a lot of times it's just sorting out those specific details and awards. And I like the concept, Ray. It's just a matter of, working
Yeah,
out the XP for the encounter.
let me tackle that one. I generally start off, everyone has the potential to get just as much experience as everyone else. So I do like to keep it even. However, I put things in there that depending on what the players do is how they could actually gain more experience, because they could do things. And just to give an example is that I actually had a festival in my game, and I listed a variety of different tasks that you could do at the festival. Some seem relatively uninteresting, and I didn't do it that way on purpose, but to actually, hold on, it was, I'm pulling up my notes now. It was actually to prepare the trenches for the festival was actually like an engineering feat to basically be the supervisor of it. Well, only one character was able to do it because everyone else thought it was crazy. Well, it offered the most bonus XP for doing this task if you succeed on that. So I feel like if the player does the risk or takes does the risk, they should get the reward. So I personally don't mind if like some players are higher level and other ones are on a lower level because you got to get involved. It's your story too. We're all there, so the opportunity is open to everyone, if
Well,
that
look at the
answers your question.
Fellowship of the Ring. It just those characters weren't all at the same experience level, if you're going to put it in terms of Pathfinder or D&D. So, I think it's interesting if you had a character that's a little bit higher level matching up with some lower level characters. It doesn't break the. I think it's good. I think it's a little bit more to run and manage, but it's just a matter of balancing the numbers.
Yeah,
Now,
well.
to follow on that, because you just raised a good point. Are we talking like one level above and one level below, or are we talking significant levels up? Because there would be a problem if one of my players was actually able to get like three levels over someone.
No,
I don't see how that could happen. Okay.
I'm talking about a tier.
Okay.
So I think in fifth
Okay.
edition, a tier is first through third.
Yeah.
Tier two is I think fifth through seventh, and I think tier three is eighth through like 12 or something. So like, would you be okay with like a say a third level party? Like say you had six players and four of them were level three, and then the rest were level one.
I think you'd have to have a good experienced group that could work together because some players might get a little resentful of someone else that can do a lot more because you've got a lot. Because those third level abilities, so you're talking a wizard can now cast fireball. So that's a first level character when someone else is flinging a fireball and they're still on their. They haven't even hit their initial. A lot of the abilities kick in at third level. So if you've got lower players, if you've got good experienced players, like I think the group that we're running, we'd be able to do that. We'd be able to because we work together and we actually had one character was higher level than the rest of us, wasn't it, when we first started
Right.
out?
I was just gonna add to the fact that the way I build my encounters, this wouldn't be so much of an issue because I account for the levels. And so eventually what you're gonna see is that the third levels won't be getting as much experience from the encounter as say the first levels. It's eventually it's gonna kinda sort of balance off. They're still gonna have a lead, but you know what I mean? The rating of the party and what I throw at them is going to be adjusted because I have to factor in the first level and the third level. So I think in the end it's gonna kind of work out.
I was just wondering, and I wasn't talking about role playing experience. I was talking about encounter experience.
Right, no, I get you.
Remember
Oh,
old school
okay.
D&D, where like if you kill the orc, only you got the experience for hitting the orc?
Yeah, I don't do that. Unless there's a specific thing, like, I mean, if there's a scenario where you truly take it on by
By yourself.
yourself,
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
then
I
I
think we
can
should
see
add that.
giving that, but otherwise, it's mainly a party type thing.
Yeah, because Greytone keeps cleaning up, but so it's just those things work out that way.
He did save the party last time.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. You're all welcome.
That lightning bolt, right?
Yeah. Although no, last one, I was really I was in kind of a bad spot because that mold thing, the ooey gooey monster we were fighting, that slime mold thing,
Yeah.
it was I was out of lightning bolts. I was didn't have fireball. I had already used ice storm, and the thing was immune to force. So it was. Or I was taking minimum damage from my Eldritch Blast and my magic missile. So I was kind of, and my wand of magic missiles did bup kiss against it when I blew four charges on it. So Greytone was a little nervous there. It was that was not cool, man.
It's a good encounter.
Okay.
So, how about one more final topic before we close this show?
Sure.
For you guys, what, how, I had kind of mentioned for myself, but you guys, how far in advance are your stories, or do you have like your ideas kind of fleshed out?
Oh, okay. Do you want me to go first?
You can go first, Rick.
Okay. So this goes back. I don't know if you have this problem anymore, Ed, but I remember when you once told me that you have a really hard time running a modern game, a modern era game like Top Secret or something that's like very modern, like with like cell phones and where players can get in cars or planes and do like a lot. You still have that problem, Ed? Have you ever ran a modern game?
I don't run any modern games right now, so.
Okay. Well, I always thought that the reason I think you had an issue with it was because you like to plan ahead. You're a planner. Me personally, I plan one session at a time. No joke. That's why my game is so, it feels, that's, I think that's why my game, and I hate to toot my own horn, but I really feel that my game feels like I'm adapting to the players. I'll have an idea, and then the players will do something, and then it's even better than my idea. And I'm like, oh, yes. And then it just looks like I planned it all because you don't know. So I adapt to the players. I do have an arc, a theme. Like if your theme is to rescue the princess, that's your goal, right? That's your theme. And I'm creating an arc in between that theme. But how you go about it, how you react, what the villains are doing, I don't ever set up like three encounters. Like I don't set up, okay, this is the adventure and the adventure is going to take a week. I don't do that. I set up one session. So like for our game for fifth edition, that's all I do. I think of one session. How many encounters do I want in this session? I pick my maps. I don't make the encounters first. I pick my map, I set up my encounter to match the map, keep it in mind to where the players are, do something cool with the encounter. Usually something role-playing wise that attaches the players to the encounter, right? Like I like doing something really out there, morbid. That's always been my thing, right? Like the darkness of all it. Like those ogres in my game. I mean, those are ogres that are breeding among themselves in a farm. You know what I mean? Like that's weird. Like that X-Files episode I told you about, like that, but with ogres. How cool is that, right? And then I just thought it was grotesque and horrible, and they're all like sleeping with their mom and creating these deformed like mongrel men slash ogres. I thought that was cool. I like that concept, right? It's scary, and the way I kind of felt it was sinister and horrible that this beautiful farm that was ran by people is gone, and these ogres have been living there for years, breeding among themselves because they've been too afraid to go anywhere else. To me, that's awesome, right? That's cool. But then you guys did like other things, and I'm like, oh. Like you guys were convinced with the cellar. Like, okay, so the session before where you guys were like, oh, we're gonna go into the cellar. Originally, that was just a basement. But then I'm like, wait a minute, I could set up a whole map down there, a cavern that's kind of growing out and then connecting to something else. So to me, it's a living entity. I don't plan ahead that far. No way. I'd lose my mind. I would try too hard to keep the players on a straight arrow, and then it just doesn't work because then you're all this prep work is for what? Which is, I think, why I'm good at running modern games, because you have to kind of be adaptive to the modern game, right? There's always something going on, something that the players always do something that you're like, oh, that's awesome. That's what I'm gonna pick on. Whether it's the Texan jumping out of a plane, whether it's a guy who thinks he's a ninja in a modern world, that doesn't matter, you know, because I'm adapting my characters around you, the villains, and the way they acted. You know, it was ridiculous, the villains I had for modern Top Secret. Top Secret is supposed to be a very gritty game, and I always stress that I'm very gritty in my game, but our game was very fantastical. It was like a bad episode of James Bond. So that answers my question of how far do I plan? I literally only plan one session at a time.
Okay. And Grey Tome, you have the campaign though, so you haven't actually. But well, you have your Starfinder game,
The
correct?
Starfinder and my homebrew D&D 5th edition game that I'm running, you know, because with Curse of Strahd, you know, that's kind of laid out for me. I kind of know where things are going, and it's just a matter of giving the players the options and they kind of go. So it's a lot of that's laid out for me. So I kind of plan like racing. I've got an idea of the theme, you know, like with the Homebrew game where that was a whole plot that I had kind of set up. I had an idea of where we're going to go was kind of creating maps and figured, okay, the players are going to kind of go along this line and they'll deviate a little bit off of that, but this is going to keep along this one track. I was building maps and setting up encounters and things, and then the players decided to do a 180 and do something I didn't expect them to do. And I had to create new characters, new encounters, and the whole adventure took a different spin. Well, and like what Ray says, you know, you gotta be flexible, and it's just, but they came up with a cool idea. It led me down a thought process that a character that was gonna be kind of two-dimensional now took on a deeper meaning. A villain that they had now has a richer backstory, and one that is, you can actually sympathize with, because there's different things that are influencing him in his encounter now and challenge with the player characters. And I've set up a whole new path of it that they wanted to take. So, you know, I usually plan, again, I have a general theme of where I want to go, but you really can't plan too much out. You can set up a bunch of different encounters, but, and even with Curse of Strahd, you know, the players are intervening in, one thing, yeah, the campaign's great. You know, it lists encounters and what's going to happen, but what it doesn't make up for is, okay, the players start having success. They start intervening in these things. How does this world respond to that? What happens next? Okay, this one encounter is going to happen and it's going to lead to this second encounter that, yes, they're separate events, but the players are now intervening and they're bringing with them a reputation, a certain level of power. And okay, that second event is modified by the players. Now they move on to this third event. Again, disconnected, but it's not in existing in a vacuum. Your actions don't just happen and everyone like forgets, like, you know, some cheesy cartoons or TV series where nothing from episode to episode carries over. It always kind of drove me mad because it's like, no, last week this happens, but it's not going to matter in the next episode because it's just all going to get washed away. It doesn't build up. And I found the best stories were ones where things did build, like Robotech. Events in earlier episodes influenced later episodes. It wasn't simply a week-to-week reset where something, no matter what happened, it was going to be set back to the beginning and there was no evolution of it. With players going through a campaign, things are changing. You know, those events that happen, word gets around. And yeah, there are challenges in that world. You know, there are ways that would go up, but it's again, it's like I kind of plan out where I think the player's going to go, but I have to remain flexible. If I get too set, they're going to throw a wrench in it.
Right. Well, obviously, I'm a little bit different than you guys because I plan out a little bit far ahead and not so much with such great detail, but just like kind of like my story arcs, what I want to do. But at the same time, I encompass things that you guys mentioned, which is the players decide. Like, as I said, I keep my notebook. And so at the end of every session, I write down, I call it outstanding items. And that's what were the players doing? What did they tell me they wanted to do? Did they rub somebody the wrong way? What quest are they on or need to do? And has anything tied in that I could tie in with my story? So I have, like, right now this major dungeon that they're in, but I actually have three other big side stories that I'm ready to pull in, but it's going to take some time to pull them in. But I have the ideas out there, and they can completely bypass that. It's not so much set in stone, but I have enough detail where I have, you know, NPC names and, you know, their background histories already written up, and I'm doing things such as, you know, basically driven with the player. But I think I do like to go out a little bit far so I can have, or to me it just makes it seem like the world is so wide open for them.
Well, yeah, you definitely want to keep it open and give everybody options, because no one wants to feel like they're pigeonholed where it's, I want to go and check out what's in that cave over there. Well, you can't. I don't have an encounter written for that, so there's nothing there. Well, then you know it's like, okay, it's kind of limiting. It's like, hey, go check out the cave. Well, you know, and you get better, I think, as you do this and you play more often and you get to know your players and your players get to know you, and then you get more experience in that. Hunters, like, okay, you know, you go into the cave, you know, maybe it is empty, but you, the way you describe it, like, you know, you build that suspense. You just don't say, oh, there's nothing there. It's like, okay, you head in and it looks like there was someone who sought shelter here. You see some tattered remains of clothing and a fire pit, and okay, now the players are wondering, is this part of the event? Is there a clue here? Maybe it's just you ad-libbing a thing that, you know, someone was in the cave, but you don't find anything of any significance. Did they miss it? They head out and they've got those questions, but it's an enriching experience.
That's the one good thing about the players, is that I agree wholeheartedly with both of you guys that if you just let the players take the lead, they'll be thinking of some stuff like, huh, I should have thought about that.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a question. I know we said we were going to stop here, but I have a question. How often do you lead players to where they need to go as a GM? Like, if you had to give yourself a percent, where do you think you are? Do you know what I mean by the question?
Out of, like, 100% or out of, like, 100%?
Like, out of 100%, yeah. Like,
I would say maybe 15%.
Really?
Very low. Yes. No.
What about you, Tony?
If they get off of, I try to accommodate the story to what they really want to do. Like, I had to do that recently where I really had to do a reset on what characters' motivations were, where we were going, because they literally pulled a 180 on me. I thought we kind of went that way, but I let them run it.
Give us a percentage. I want to hear your percentage.
Probably 20% of the time. I kind of try to be as flexible as I can. I kind of have an idea, but I don't really push them into a thing. What I'll do is, if they kind of run off, like what I had to do here was, they, okay, so I'll kind of let you know what the scenario was. They were went out to this dungeon. They were looking for historical artifacts for this lord who wanted found evidence that his family had a very influential, wealthy past, when they had much more influence in the realm than they do currently. And he wanted to try and reclaim that. And he thought that part of the way to do that was to get this book and, you know, reclaim that lineage of his. So the players go out. Well, they realize that this family's history apparently is not a good one. It's deeply embedded in the necromantic arts and evil forces and powers. And the players decide that, well, the story I had lined up was that, okay, they're leading this encounter. They're going to return the book to this guy. And then this lord's going to say, well, I want to go and find this thing. Let's go look for this historical home. Well, you're going right into the pit of evil. Well, the characters decide, no, we're not going to go back and see him. We're going to take the paladin. The group is like, no, I'm taking this book. We're going to my church. We're going to turn this over. We're going to see if this book can be destroyed or what to be done. Well, that was a completely opposite way from where I wanted to go. So I either had to say, no, you're not going to do that, or let it ride. And so I had to rework the adventure, create new characters, a whole new thing, and then what was the motivation of the antagonist now, and it led to a different thing. So I try to, if I have a theme, I know where I want to go with venture. How we get from point A to point B, I kind of let them fill in. And I try not say, okay, you have to go here. I kind of let them lead themselves there, and then just kind of, and I'll change it, you know, I'll change the story to get them to this point, you know. And it's just, it takes a little bit of reworking and rewriting, but not very often do I tell them where they have to go. You know, and what, it's just
Okay, so
what's your percentage? Okay,
so before I give you my percentage, how much do you think I lead you in the game that I'm running with you guys, if you had to give me a percentage before? And I'll give you my honest percentage, what I think
I don't think you really do. I'm saying, you know, we seem to have a lot of flexibility with where we go. I mean, you kind of put out an adventure for us, then we could say no. So maybe 40% of the time?
My first thought was 50%.
I would say I'm up probably up higher in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah. Now, here, okay, so I think we have a misunderstanding though of what I'm talking about. So I know what you're talking about, Tony. I agree with you on that. About like leading character. I don't lead them to certain encounters. I'm talking like back briefing them, making them understand your arc and your theme. Do you back brief your players? I certainly do.
What do you mean by back brief?
Okay,
Let's get on the same page.
can I give you an example? I want to actually brought something up on one of my games. So I'm just going to read it verbatim. So this is on Roll20, my Game of Thrones game. Because Game of Thrones is a complicated game. If players don't take notes, for example, you can't force players to take notes, right? So if, let's say none of your players took notes, would you tell them things because they didn't take notes? Yes or no?
I would tell them, yeah, because I'm like, I'll bring, I do a recap, I
Right.
kind of keep
Well,
track of
okay.
that stuff.
For
Yeah.
me, it depends. Like I'll do a basic recap, but I don't give you all the
Okay.
details if
So
you would have kept notes.
let me read this to you. Okay. It's very short. It's like literally like 4 or 5 sentences here, like a little less than paragraph. I said, okay, again, reading it verbatim. Again, folks, I'm only helping you explain the plot points and summarize the critical information for a short time. Since this adventure is a tutorial to the game, I'm being very generous with you all. After this adventure is complete, I will not be helping you at all, as I expect you to understand and keep up with the narrator of this story, yours truly. You are expected to read the forums. The other house information is public knowledge with a few rumors and perceptions that you all hold and gather among your contacts, friends, education, etc. This doesn't mean that what's on the forum is true, but you can gather new intelligence and will constantly change as you discover more information about certain political figures. I intentionally created weaknesses and strengths to every house for you to exploit. Take advantage of the information that I've posted. If you have any question about that information, please let me know and I'll be more than happy to answer them. Remember that once you leave House Barnell, you will not have contact with them and they do not have a maester, so a raven cannot be sent to that location. The only other way to communicate with House Barnell will be by carrier, which will take about a month for a returned response. Time is of the essence. You all have to be wondering why you were all chosen to get this task done. Some of you have been very open with my theories, but my favorite one that I've heard from you all, in no particular order, are: Lady Barnell was testing you all on the first session to see who was loyal to her. Two, Lady Barnell is waiting for you all to leave to execute her plan to kill her husband. Three, someone is manipulating things in the background. Why else would Edmure Tully be going south to King's Landing? Four, House Frey wants Lord Barnell best to not be present because they plan to attack while you're all gone, the best fighters of the house. Six, Lord Barnell wants you all to cause friction in other houses so he can take advantage of that, increasing the power of the house. And of course, last, the PC, the saboteur, is working for House Lannister and ensuring you all decrease the influence and power of your house, of House Barnell and the Riverlands. These are all good points, but all the possibilities of what you have to do. You have to understand what I'm trying to get accomplished. If you have any questions, please ask. Right? So that's me leading the players because I have a very clear direction and I want them to be in the same sheet of music that I am. And I do this a lot with you guys in my game. How many times do I have to give you summaries or give you an explanation of what's going on and what the king might be thinking? It helps you focus yourself on the goal that I established for you, and then you as players, because we've known each other for so long, I think have a basic understanding of what I want and you follow through, but it's your action. You understand?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'll keep track of logs and Roll20 is really useful doing that,
Yeah.
where I'll summarize the previous adventures of events, and then with Curse of Strahd, it was, I wrote out, okay, these are the adventure hooks basically that you have open that you can choose from. Where do you want to go? You may not necessarily be able to do everything because some of those objectives are going to take you in opposite directions or they'll conflict with each other. And so it's, but I yeah, that's I think really cool, Ray. So I think that helps out a lot in kind of guiding them that, hey, there is a story to be told. So.
When I think of leading, I think of that, sort of like in your campaign, that no matter what we do, all roads would lead to a showdown with the evil, the Raven God, or something like that. Whereas, like, no matter which option I choose, is going to get me here.
Well, I mean,
that's what I. But no, I'm just saying, so we can get on the same page.
That's true to every DM. I don't think there's one DM who doesn't do that. Come on. How many times have you built a map that lead to the main boss? Have you ever really just had a dead end or a way out and just be like, okay, no one does that. If you do that, you're a bad GM.
Oh yeah, exactly. Cause you don't want to leave players to
like that's why the maze is probably the most, I'd say that the dumbest thing a GM can do. Like, what, are the players going to get lost in the maze? No.
Well, yes.
No, they're not, Ed. No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
No, they're going to end up in the maze, and eventually they're going to get out, or you're going to let them.
Well, yeah, eventually they're going to get out, but it's the journey of getting out that I'm after.
You can do it. To me, it's a waste of time. I'll never use. I might do like a small little maze just to like.
With agree to disagree on that one.
With something to hunt them or go after them, but in general. I've never been a big fan of setting counters in different rooms, just waiting to do things. Like I just don't get that at all.
Agree to disagree. I find that if done right, it can be nice experience.
In certain ways, it's okay. Like if it was Mithranor, if it was the Tomb of Horrors, like if it was a wizard's tower, then that's understandable. If it's a mansion or a Strahd game, that's understandable. Those are setting counters in a building, a house.
Yeah.
And this is just for all the people who are actually listening to the podcast. First, thank you. And second, sometimes I always feel like it's called Dungeons and Dragons. What happened to the dungeons and what happened to the dragons? That seems to be the two things that we're always missing in the game of Dungeons and Dragons is Dungeons and Dragons. Okay. That's why I disagree with my esteemed colleague,
Art of Magnus. I like dungeons. I just never been a big fan of just dungeons. It leaves for, in my opinion, it leaves for poor role playing. And it does, whether you believe that or not, it does.
Be careful, Greytone.
No, because you know what? Role playing among players isn't role playing. Role playing among players is not role playing, guys.
That's true. It depends. It depends. Once again, everything depends. If two players have a conflict and they role play it out, even almost come to blows, that is role play.
Yeah, okay, but that's that is so like to me, role playing should be a moral dilemma, or it should, or it should be having to deal with the situation and taking the lesser evil of something, and it's being between a rock and a hard place. Think of Mass Effect, right? You're either the bad guy or you're the good guy. You know what I mean? There's no in between. You're either going to go far left, far right, or you're going to right in the middle, which is fine. But eventually, you have to make choices. Eventually, things have to happen that bring conflict to the party. And in a dungeon, not to say that you couldn't do it in a dungeon. I'm not saying that. But like, if you have a set dungeon, like, could there be prisoners in there? Could there be someone being held captive? That's role-playing. I get that. But compare that to being in a city with multiple NPCs who have political agendas to ruin you, where adventurers can't go around killing things all the time because there's laws that have been established to prevent them from doing it. And that they have to understand that there's people more powerful than them that tell them what they can and cannot
do. That's what I'm talking about.
And you will obey, because if you do not obey, you will suffer the goddamn consequences of that, right? That's what's important, not, I mean, again, it's all a matter of, all that matters is that your players like your game and that's what you discussed. I'm not saying my way is the right way. It's just my preference, right? It's my style of game is, I understand, different from Tony's and from yours. And we all have different themes. Like, again, we talked this before. Marvel Superheroes to Tony is the golden age of comics. To me, it's Marvel Knights, the Punisher, Ghost Rider, Venom. Anti-heroes, killing, civil war kind of stuff, you know. While for Tony, it's literally being the superhero with a cape, flying around saving kittens from trees. It doesn't make the game any less or any worse. It's just as fun and just as awesome. It's just a matter of preference of what you like.
Because nobody wants to leave kittens in trees, man. The Punisher, maybe the Punisher would be a little happier if he would stop every once in a while and save some of those kittens. So the guys in the capes could do something else, like when Galactus shows up, you know. Yeah, so, but you know? But no, it's a different gaming style, absolutely. You know, I run a a more Golden Age thing, and I, you know, with the RP, you know, it's you know, in my games a lot of times, yeah, it's inter-character. But it's a lot more often the role playing is interacting with the NPCs in the world, and trying to go, like in the Starfinder game, one of the characters, first level guy, he's getting hammered by a space goblin honcho man, you know, the space goblin leader, who's a level 2 character. This is 7 first level characters up against 7 space goblins and 1 honcho man. So I got 8 space goblins coming up against them. So I basically paired one off against each and then kind of figured, okay, the honcho man's heavy duty. So this guy just decides, like, okay, I'm you know what, I'm not taking any guff from this guy. Gets jacked by a laser blaster shot and, you know, takes out his stamina. He's going into hit point loss and he's still charging on there, and he's rolling intimidate rolls that are doing real well, just kind of staring this guy down. So the space goblin is, you know, and it broke down combat into this war of wills, you know, where these two were making will and charisma checks to see who was going to be able to basically force the other one to back down. And he pulled it off. Now, that did help out with a critical hit from his laser blaster at near point blank range in the space goblin, which, you know, caused the guy to catch fire. And so I had this whole thing where the goblin's head was on fire. And, you know, it's just so we kind of worked out that way. But it was that player really enjoyed that encounter because it came less about the weapons and the ranged attack rolls, but it was the intimidate checks back and forth to see who's going to back down. So and it's like, OK, what are you saying? What are you doing? I'm role playing the space goblin, just, you know, arguing back with you. So it you know, I have a lot of fun with that, and I really enjoy it. And I think we really got to get the opportunity to give the players a chance to role play and you know.
And so what my takeaway from this is that we definitely need to have another podcast, another session, and we're going to start off talking about role playing because that seems to be a hot topic here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of different ways to do it. So,
and with that note, I want to thank both Arta Magnus and Gray Tone for doing this Spur of the Moment podcast. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for listening and tune in for another podcast down the line. Thanks, everyone.
Yep. Thank you, everybody.
Have a good one.